Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Olwen Murphy from Johns Hopkins University and Dr. Matthew Vogt of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The pair joined the show to talk about the awareness around the current state of care for acute flaccid myelitis following AFM Awareness Month and the return of the peak season for the infection. Without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Olwen Murphy. I'm an assistant professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins University. I specialize in neuroimmunology, treatment of patients with immune-mediated disorders such as multiple sclerosis, transverse myelitis, and other infectious and inflammatory disorders.
My name is Matt Vogt. I'm an assistant professor of pediatric infectious diseases at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And so I see patients in the pediatrics hospital with infectious diseases, but I'm also a member of our Department of Microbiology and Immunology and do a lot of basic science work around the study of pathogenesis of enterovirus infections, the antibody responses to those infections in humans. And a lot of that has a lot of impact on the study of acute flaccid myelitis and how we understand that disease.
Definitely. Well, I guess from the neurology perspective, AFM or acute flaccid myelitis sort of emerged as a sort of newly recognized illness over the last 12 to 15 years or so. It tends to affect children primarily. So what was recognized was outbreaks initially in areas like Colorado and California of children with a paralytic illness, which looked very similar to polio. So children would report a viral illness, maybe respiratory symptoms, coughing and wheezing, and then a few days later experience acute severe weakness, typically affecting one or more limbs, and then in severe cases affecting the muscles of breathing and speaking and swallowing. So severely affected children were ending up in intensive care units with this paralytic illness. And it was only over time when this pattern of cases of acute flaccid myelitis was emerging kind of every 2 years or so since around 2010, 2012, that the link with an infectious etiology was made, and the sort of worlds of neurology and infectious diseases kind of have come together. And there's been accruing evidence over the years on the specific types of viruses that can trigger AFM, in particular enterovirus D68. Which is thought to be the main trigger for the vast majority of cases of AFM. So now we've moved into the phase more of recognizing that as the primary cause of AFM and what can we do about that.
So as Dr. Murphy said, we progressed from what we would initially call an association of two things. We had lots of kids getting respiratory illnesses. Oftentimes those respiratory illnesses could be attributed to this virus, enterovirus D68, sort of in the same time frame, within a couple of days typically of their weakness setting in. Now that's an association, that's not causation. And over the past many years, we've done a lot of work, and I say we as the global scientific community, but there's been a lot of work done to really link these two and show that this is definitely a virus that causes the vast majority of cases of AFM. Certainly where we have a lot of good epidemiologic data around AFM in the United States and in Europe, the initial way these were linked was, again, just sort of very sort of a timing thing. So lots of respiratory illness and lots of this paralytic illness sort of in close proximity to each other. There's now been a lot of work showing in mice and that when we infect mice with NRBRST68, they develop an illness. They can develop an illness that sort of resembles AFM, and they also get disease in the anterior horn motor neurons and their spinal cord, the same place where we see a lot of the pathology when we do imaging of patients with AFM. But then also back in the summer of 2019, I believe it was, there were two groups that did really nice complementary studies that used slightly different methods, but came to almost the exact same conclusion, which was really nice and made it a very, very believable conclusion, where they saw a lot of patients with AFM. When they looked at the spinal fluid from those patients, they had antibodies to enterovirus, or in some cases, specifically enterovirus D68, something on the order of 70 to 80% of those patients, they could find those antibodies. And then when they looked at spinal fluid from people with, you know, everything else under the sun where they could get their hands on spinal fluid, it was more like maybe 7 or 8%. So there was, you know, a very dramatic increase in the presence of enterovirus antibodies in the spinal fluid of patients with AFM. That was another really big moment where we kind of had the association more tightly linked to, say, a causation. And then we, meaning a group of people that I'm working with, recently were able to re-examine an autopsy from a patient who was a five-year-old boy, and he had died of what we would now call AFM back in 2008. We really didn't actually use the term AFM until 2014, when sort of was developed as a case definition by the CDC. But that patient is one of the few patients who's not only died during the acute phase of their illness of acute flaccid myelitis, in this case, about 3 days into the onset of weakness, but also one of the few patients who's had an autopsy in that same setting. So we were able to really take advantage of this sort of unique set of samples that I really searched far and wide and called everybody I knew and everyone I could try to get to know to find other samples to do the same studies on. And what we saw was that the virus, enterovirus D68, both RNA, which is the type of genome this virus has, and protein of the virus capsid, the shell that surrounds that RNA genome, we found that present in the neurons in those same spots that we suspect the anterior horns of the spinal cord where the motor neurons live, and really showing that at least at that time point in infection, this is definitely a neurotropic virus, definitely infects the neurons. And there's a lot of inflammatory cells around too, which the question would be, are the inflammatory cells helpful or in fact potentially harmful in this case, you know, killing the neurons that are infected. So I'd say now we're very confident that this virus that is enterovirus D68, that really is, for all intents and purposes, it's a respiratory pathogen. It behaves just like the common cold, except in the small number of cases where it does invade the central nervous system. It infects those motor neurons in the spinal cord, and it causes this acute flaccid myelitis. I'd say that the causation link is no longer really a question. It's just a matter of now continuing to push our understanding of, you know, what are the steps that lead from what is typically a very harmless respiratory tract infection, but in the unlucky few, you know, why are those people the unlucky few, and how is the virus doing it? How is the virus causing the paralysis? Those are definitely studies that are ongoing in multiple groups, not just ours.
It sounds like a lot of this, I mean, obviously there's still some gaps in the knowledge that, you know, you just alluded to that we need to figure out, but it does sound like a lot of this came together relatively quickly. You know, all things considered. So, you know, how has, I guess, the approach to, you know, both identifying this and sort of figuring out the epidemiologic portion of it, you know, who are, how many of those unlucky few, you know, where are we at on that side of things? And how close are we to potentially completing that research that could maybe identify what happened, you know, what this cascade of events is?
I can take a stab at that first. So I don't think we'll ever fully understand everything. And the reason I say that is because the original acute flaccid myelitis is what we know of as poliomyelitis. So poliomyelitis, you know, acute flaccid myelitis is a clinical syndrome. So if a patient comes into the hospital with this acute onset of a flaccid limb weakness, you know, there's a differential diagnosis that goes along with that. And if we determine it's acute flaccid myelitis that they have, there's a lot of different viruses that can cause AFM. So enterovirus D68 seems to be the main driver of these periodic outbreaks that Dr. Murphy spoke of, but really a lot of different enteroviruses can cause this. Other viruses like West Nile virus can cause this. And then, you know, the original virus that caused what we would call AFM now is poliovirus. And that's one of the most well-studied viruses out there. And yet we still don't understand everything about the pathogenesis of poliovirus. We understand a lot, but I wouldn't say we understand everything. So, you know, this is an area of research that I'm sure will be continuing to be going down for many, many years. I think from a clinician standpoint, you know, when are we going to be able to understand who's the people that are going to get paralyzed and how we can disrupt that paralysis? You know, I'm sure that it's going to end up being a multifactorial process because there's a whole lot of NRVRST68 infections. And relative to that, not nearly so many cases of acute flaccid myelitis. You know, we've done work that shows that probably having antibodies, you know, circulating neutralizing antibodies to the virus in your bloodstream, that should prevent you from getting paralyzed, which is good because that means that it's likely a vaccine preventable illness. There's good research out there from some vaccine labs that shows that this is very likely a virus that can be vaccinated against and at least prevent illness in terms of paralysis. It may not prevent infection, so you may still get a cold in your nose, but I think we're all okay with a cold in our nose when the alternative is paralysis due to spinal cord infection. So we're trying to understand some of those steps on how the virus gets from the nose into the spinal cord. And then there's many groups, as I said, that are doing that as well. How soon will we know everything? I don't know that we'll know everything, but I have recently been to a couple of virology meetings. I'd say it's a growing field. There are definitely more and more people jumping in to understand this important pathogen because, you know, it causes a pretty frightening illness. You know, otherwise healthy children suddenly coming down with paralysis, I think we can all agree is not something we want. And it's something we want to understand so we can be done with it and get over it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think definitely the fact that it seems like it could be vaccinated against, I imagine, is probably a plus on that side of things. I agree. I would take the cold over paralysis 100 out of 100 times. Dr. Murphy, I know we alluded a little bit to the differential diagnosis of this, and I know there are some diagnostic criteria that exist that you were a part of. So, you know, how is that diagnosis currently made? And, you know, are there any challenges in identifying? I mean, it does sound like there are some pretty characteristic, obviously, symptoms that once this infection takes hold and you know, if that paralysis does happen, it sounds like we're able to identify it at that point. But, you know, are there any sort of holes in that or challenges in identifying this? And obviously, I imagine speed is of the essence for a lot of these patients. So kind of where are we at in the diagnostic process?
Absolutely. Well, definitely the diagnostic sort of situation has evolved considerably over the last 10 years. As Dr. Vogt mentioned, CDC started monitoring cases of potential AFM back in 2014. And they were using a sort of a catch-all kind of criterion for identifying cases that would capture as many cases as possible. A fairly rudimentary case definition. The problem that emerged over time, and at least one study showed this from a scientific perspective, is that the case definition that was being used was a little bit too vague or broad and was detecting a number of other spinal cord illnesses, for example, spontaneous spinal cord infarctions or unusual cases of inflammatory myelopathy. These are transverse myelitis. So the sort of community of researchers in AFM recognized this over the years. And over the last few years, we actually worked together in a sort of collaborative approach. Multiple institutions across America and actually across the globe were involved in developing a new consensus diagnostic criteria for AFM. And there was many fruitful debates amongst the sort of community on the most important aspects of the disease to define it. Because similar to many other neurological disorders, there's no single test to diagnose AFM. We can't do one blood test and say, yes, this patient has AFM. So we need to recognize a number of clinical and paraclinical factors in order to make that diagnosis. Those would include the sort of historical features of the story, such as a viral illness preceding it, typically the patient being under 18 years of age, and then elements of the examination, such as flaccid weakness, lack of reflexes in the affected limb, quite an acute onset over hours to days. And then you've got supportive evidence. For example, in the spinal fluid, we would typically see a pleocytosis with elevated white cells in the order of tens or hundreds. And then the MRI does show quite characteristic findings in the spinal cord with gray matter hyperintensity. So the consensus criteria that we developed as a group kind of draws on those elements of the history, examination, CSF and MRI findings in a sort of algorithmic approach. So by considering the presence or absence of each of those features in an individual case, we can make a diagnosis with more certainty as to whether this looks like AFM or whether we should be considering some of the other things that might mimic AFM, like other inflammatory myelopathies or other infections. So those criteria were published in The Lancet back in 2020, and I think have helped clinicians be a little bit more certain about the diagnosis. And we would hope that over time they'll also help research efforts, because we should be more aligned now in what we are actually defining as AFM in order to move the field further.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Drs. Murphy and Vogt to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, recently announced findings from the Migraine and Mental Health Connection Survey show that most physicians and patients with migraine believe that there is a significant impact from mental health and vice versa, with authors noting that stigma remains a major issue for patients who are looking to further discuss their mental state. Ultimately, the data revealed that 91% of HCPs and 67% of patients with migraine believe that better migraine and mental health management go hand in hand. Next, the FDA has issued a CRL to Acadia Pharmaceuticals for its sNDA for pimavanserin, or Nuplazid, for the treatment of hallucinations and delusions in patients with Alzheimer's disease psychosis. The agency could not approve the application as it currently stands and recommended that Acadia conduct an additional trial in AD psychosis. Next, the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, or ICER, published its revised evidence report assessing the comparative clinical effectiveness and value of two treatments for ALS, AMX-35, an investigational agent from Amylyx Pharmaceuticals, and oral edaravone, or Radicava, from Mitsubishi Tanabe. The report indicated that the incremental cost-effectiveness of oral edaravone far exceeded the typical cost-effectiveness threshold across multiple analyses, and if priced similarly, the incremental cost-effectiveness of AMX-35 would also far exceed typical thresholds. Finally, the FDA communicated to Reata Pharmaceuticals that it has extended the review period for the company's NDA for omaveloxolone, an investigational agent for the treatment of Friedreich ataxia, as a result of newly submitted and supportive data from the MOXIe trial program. The new Prescription Drug User Fee Act action date has been moved 3 months and is now set for February 28th, 2023. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now back to Dr. Murphy and Dr. Vogt.
Once a patient is diagnosed, what's kind of the state of care for them? Because it does sound like, again, you know, based on what we saw early on, you know, this could be a fatal condition, to have to deal with. Do we have any treatments that are readily available, you know, knowing that we do kind of have a solid understanding of sort of this family of viruses that are most likely the suspect here? What is that? The timing of that process from sort of, you know, the patient presents, we get them diagnosed, and then we start working toward treatment.
So I guess I can answer regarding the sort of current clinical care of patients with AFM is still very much focused on supportive care. We don't have any evidence-based treatments. So there's been no positive randomized controlled trials, for example, in AFM, telling us that there's useful treatments that can alter the course of the disease. What we do know is that from a diagnostic perspective, it is helpful, and it's probably going to improve outcomes over the long term to diagnose early. Because that, first of all, prevents exposure of patients to potentially toxic treatments. For example, in some cases of inflammatory myelopathies that are not responsive will go on to get treatments like cyclophosphamide cytoxin infusions, which we know are toxic to neuronal stem cells. So we first of all want to avoid patients getting treated for things they don't have. And then the second aspect is to initiate patients on an early program of rehabilitation and also the appropriate supportive care. So recognizing that AFM is an illness that can cause respiratory compromise, for example, and early recognition of that and transferring patients to the appropriate unit of the hospital to avoid any sort of hypoxic injury that could occur if the patient experiences severe neuromuscular weakness with respiratory compromise. So the elements of the supportive care can be a little bit focused on AFM, and then the rehabilitation is so important and is the primary means for our patients at the moment for regaining their independence and their quality of life. So they're sort of facilitated by the early diagnosis.
And then, I mean, this kind of for both of you, you know, because again, this is a kind of multifaceted condition we're talking about, obviously includes a variety of different providers, all, you know, from kind of your both specialties and then into the rehab realm, of course. So when it comes to the actual, you know, a patient's presenting with what we might suspect be AFM, we're going to start considering initiating this diagnostic process to confirm that. Who's kind of in the room and who are we consulting in those moments? You know, are we getting on the phone with a neurologist and an infectious disease expert? Is this something that can be diagnosed solely by one or the other? Is there preference there? Because again, it does sound like there's just a lot going on in this instance. And clearly, again, you know, the sooner the better. So what's kind of that process in terms of the care involved?
Yeah. Well, hopefully, at this point, AFM is a more well-recognized syndrome than it was, you know, back when we first started using the term only a couple of years ago. You know, this is best recognized as part of the differential diagnosis by the first provider to see a patient, whether that's their, you know, this is typically a pediatric disease, almost exclusively, in fact. So this could be a primary care pediatrician, could be an urgent care provider, could be an ED provider. And if, you know, this child has, you know, especially if they've had a recent antecedent illness and then suddenly comes in and they just have a fairly progressive weakness developing in one or more of their limbs, and especially if it's in the sort of late summer, early fall months when we'll often see peaks of this disease. Although to be clear, this disease can happen any time of the year. You know, we really want to make sure that patient gets plugged in pretty quickly to facilities, like Dr. Murphy said, where if they need it, they can have really advanced respiratory support. You know, we can help them with, you know, supplementary feeding and things like that, because in the worst form of this disease, it can progress very rapidly over, you know, even just 24 hours, 48, 72 hours, you know, from when they first have some weakness to having really every voluntary muscle in their body can be paralyzed. They can't swallow, they can't breathe. So, you know, it can be a very rapidly progressive, very severe illness. But nobody needs to die from it. So if we can, you know, we're really good at supporting people through the inability to breathe in this case. When just the muscles aren't working, we can compensate for that. So who all would be involved at the front end? Well, as soon as this enters the differential diagnosis, I would say that's a time when you're really going to try to reach out to a facility that has that sort of advanced ICU level care to offer, even though the patient may not need it in that moment. The worry is that they may need it very soon in the next day or two. And so you know, you don't want to be reacting at that point. You want them to be able to have that care that they need immediately. And then I would definitely say you'd want to be able to have a neurologist available to help you with ordering, because usually the differential is quite broad at the front. And so there's a lot of different testing, and I'll touch on the infectious testing, but there's a lot of other neurologic syndromes, as Dr. Murphy has mentioned, that, you know, have some overlap with the presentation of AFM, and you're really going to want a neurologist to help you sort through that. But specifically on the infectious testing front, so, you know, we've mentioned a couple of viruses, enterovirus D68 being the main one, but there are other viruses, like even we just had a vaccine-derived poliovirus case that happened in New York just a few weeks back. Enterovirus A71 is another major virus that will cause this disease. There's a lot of non-enteroviruses too. So the sooner we can test, the sooner we can gather the biological specimens where we can try to find a virus, that can be a very helpful part of the, of sorting out that differential diagnosis. You know, one viral test on its own doesn't necessarily prove that we know what we're talking about, unless it's like acute onset weakness, and then you have poliovirus in the stool. You're going to be pretty darn suspicious that you got a case of poliomyelitis on your hands. You know, some of these tests are going to be more helpful than others. But in general, when you're still in that very first couple, you know, moments where you're like, boy, this patient might have acute flaccid myelitis. Aside from sort of, you know, you're doing a lot of things simultaneously. You're reaching out to your colleagues with neurology expertise. You may reach out to an infectious disease specialist. You may reach out to other people. But if you can gather the biological specimens in that moment for the testing, even if your facility isn't capable of doing the testing, if you have the specimens, the sooner we get them, the sooner we're likely to, the more likely we are to be able to find a viral etiology. And so those specimens are going to be a respiratory sample. Actually, it's even better if you can get nasopharyngeal and oropharyngeal swabs for that. You're going to want a stool sample. And sometimes these patients present pretty constipated. So the muscles of the bowel have actually been affected as well. So you can do a rectal swab will also suffice in that case. And then blood and then spinal fluid. And between those four specimens, you know, those are the sites we're most likely to find either an enterovirus or evidence of infection of an enterovirus or evidence of West Nile virus infection or some of these other pathogens that can also be at play here. So at least from an ID doctor's perspective and my sort of myopic viewpoint, with my blinders on, like that's what I think of as one of the first things. But you know, Dr. Murphy maybe can talk about, there's also a lot of other tests you'll want to be doing right off the bat as well in terms of MRI and other things you're going to want to do with the blood and the spinal fluid, not just testing for infections as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say, Dr. Murphy, you know, from the neuro perspective, what are kind of the first tests that you're thinking of calling if we're suspecting?
Of course, yeah. So I suppose what you're thinking about when the patient comes in the door is the differential diagnosis of acute severe weakness and more specifically, I guess, acute flaccid weakness, although it can be a little bit hard to differentiate because in the early phases, even a lot of spinal cord syndromes can present with a sort of early flaccid phase. So the common differential diagnosis that you need to be thinking about are both peripheral nerve and spinal cord. From the peripheral nerve perspective, you can have unusual toxic myopathies or toxic neuropathies, for example, rare types of exposures, but most commonly would be Guillain-Barré syndrome. Now, Guillain-Barré syndrome can often be easy enough to differentiate from AFM because typically Guillain-Barré syndrome has a clear sensory component and AFM is a pure motor disorder. However, there is a rare form of Guillain-Barré syndrome called the acute motor axonal neuropathy variant, which can be very difficult to differentiate from AFM just on the clinical basis in the acute setting. Then from the other perspective, from the central side of things, there are a number of disorders of the spinal cord that can mimic AFM and causing a predominantly flaccid pattern of weakness. Those would be spontaneous spinal cord infarction, which often affects the gray matter more than the white matter. And then some other infections and inflammatory conditions. For example, MOGAD, myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein antibody associated disorder, can manifest with a primarily gray matter myelitis. So the things that you need to be thinking about upfront with that sort of differential diagnosis are the sort of classic high yield neurological tests, which is a spinal fluid, CSF. And in AFM, that typically shows a pleocytosis, whereas in other disorders, mimics such as spinal cord infarction, that would be expected to show normal cells or maybe a very, very mild increased cell count. And then Guillain-Barré syndrome also has that classic CSF profile of cytoalbuminologic dissociation, where you get very highly elevated protein and less highly elevated white cells. So straight away from the CSF, you might be getting a hint that this is an infectious disorder with that high white cell count that we would expect in AFM. And then from the MRI perspective, this is really the other most useful diagnostic test in the acute setting for differentiating AFM from other myelopathic disorders. With AFM, we would expect to see a central cord hyperintensity. The gray matter is in the center of the cord, and that's the area most affected with AFM. There's typically swelling of the central cord, and so that may manifest with sort of a bulky spinal cord, typically in the cervical and the lumbar regions, where there's the highest concentration of motor neurons that supply both the arms and the legs. And when you compare AFM to other disorders, there's another few characteristic features. So AFM is unlikely to show areas of focal enhancement. And it's unlikely to show a sort of specific owl's eye type appearance you might get in the early phase of a spontaneous spinal cord infarction. So the MRI is very useful. And we don't forget about the brain when we're doing the MRI, because the disorder of AFM can also affect the motor nuclei that supply the cranial nerves. So when you look at an MRI brain in an AFM patient, you may see increased signal in the dorsal midbrain and medulla, which is where those motor nuclei lie. And that can be also very helpful in differentiating from some other disorders. So what we would say to people is do a full MRI, the whole spine, the brain, do spinal fluid study. Those initial tests are hopefully going to point you in the direction of AFM. Sometimes at a later date, sometimes days or weeks later, nerve conduction studies and EMG can be helpful in just being a little bit more certain that this is a motor neuronopathy, essentially. But at the front end of things, think of your CSF and MRI studies.
Absolutely. And obviously July was just, you know, just ended, but was AFM Awareness Month. And it sounds like, again, the sort of statistically most likely odds on first person to potentially see these patients is going to be a pediatric focused care. So for you guys, I guess, what's kind of the messaging that you would have liked or would like now that, you know, we are potentially entering that, you know, perhaps peak season you alluded to, Dr. Vogt? You know, what would you like that community to know? Is there a challenge with, you know, is this something they're acutely aware of? I imagine it's not extraordinarily common, but regardless, is this something that, you know, since it is a relatively newly defined condition, we do finally have, you know, some diagnostic criteria to work with. Is that community who would be sort of our first line of defense, are they aware enough? Is there any messaging you'd like to get to them to sort of help them better identify these cases when they do come out? I know we just talked a lot about that diagnostic process once it's suspect, but are there any other gaps or any other messages you guys would like to share?
No, I do think that at least pediatricians as a whole, which is, you know, sort of another community that I'm a part of, the American Academy of Pediatrics has participated a lot with groups like the CDC or the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and sort of partnered together to produce a lot of educational material. So there's, for example, free courses available through the American Academy of Pediatrics PediaLink website around acute flaccid myelitis. And those are actually, those can be a little hard to find on their own, but if you just go to the CDC's acute flaccid myelitis sort of webpage, amongst all of the many, many resources on that webpage, is a link to that. So I think nowadays pediatricians are more and more aware, I wouldn't consider myself a part of the community of like emergency room or urgent care providers necessarily. But I think also that's another group that we've tried really hard to make outreach to make sure that, you know, they're aware that this is something that presents. And, you know, I think the reason, or at least one reason, that July is a really good month to be acute flaccid myelitis awareness month is because we have seen in the past these peaks of AFM illness during years where we do have big spikes. Really is sort of like August, September, October are the main peak months. So to be aware heading into those months is, you know, a really good thing. And so definitely for the next few months, if you see a child that, you know, again, has especially an antecedent just febrile illness, especially with respiratory components, but could also be sort of a febrile GI type illness. And then, you know, within a few days, or even as that illness is starting to subside, they have this acute onset of weakness or cranial nerve changes. Sometimes it can be painful in these affected limbs, but oftentimes not. Sometimes they can have sort of that meningismus that comes with having a bit of a meningitis component as well. Any of those things should really make you at least think about AFM. And then maybe you find an alternative diagnosis quickly, that's fine. But if AFM remains on your differential, reach out. You know, I would really, really stress, you know, even as someone who studies AFM, if I'm worried about this clinically and a patient of mine, I'm reaching out to my neurology colleagues, hands down, you know, and I'm really doing that. I'm also pulling out Dr. Murphy's Lancet article. And I just want to say thank you for all the effort that went into that. I was very peripherally involved at the end, more like doing like spell checking. I was not super involved in those efforts, but it's a really comprehensive article. And it's also one of these things. I tell everybody, if it's on your differential and you want some resources, I just Google CDC AFM, loads and loads of resources on the CDC AFM webpage. And actually one of the main resources that they highlight is that Lancet article, which is just a really well written article that goes through the differential that you may want to consider, aspects of all these diseases, basically a lot of what Dr. Murphy just said. So rather than trying to remember this podcast, because you know, my memory is not often the best, a lot of that is really nicely laid out, very, very easy to reference in that Lancet article too. So I guess that's another thing I would say is if it's on your differential, aside from reaching out to neurology friends, the CDC's AFM website is just loaded with great resources, including that article. There's a link right there.
Yeah, I think that was a great summary. I think there's resources out there available when AFM is a suspect diagnosis, because we recognize that this is a rare illness. And most physicians who are going to encounter this might be the only case they ever encounter in their life. So reach out to your colleagues. That's what we're here for, these people specializing in research of this rare disorder, through the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, through the CDC. There's help available in the larger academic centers to help diagnose these cases and sometimes transfer affected patients. And I guess from the first meeting perspective, what frustrates many of our parents of AFM children, I've had the privilege to work with many families affected by AFM, and what's very traumatic for parents sometimes is that their child has been discharged from an urgent care department or an emergency department with AFM because it wasn't recognized. It may have been at an early stage. And the manifestations can be quite mild initially. And one of the unusual things about AFM is it can affect the arms first in some cases. So often we have a child that presents a few days into a viral illness with focal weakness in one arm. And, you know, the diagnosis entertained is something like a compressive neuropathy or something like that. And the patient's discharged home and deteriorates rapidly. So I would just flag for any physicians in those sort of acute care environments that in a child with a viral illness and focal weakness, you need to be thinking about AFM and the potential for deterioration.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.